The mass movement on the streets took up the question of the undemocratic courts. And at that time it was won by a combination of street activity, mass movement, military activity and hunger strike.
These prisoners went on hunger strike way back in 1972 and won what was called special category, which was a kind of political status. But they won that through hard graft and through suffering and through hunger strikes.
We won recognition for the prisoners that in a country which has a special political problem, special powers of arrest, powers of interrogation, special courts and special prison sentences, that they had special prisoners. Because the Act specifies in its opening paragraph the scheduled offences as being those with a political motive, we call that special status political status because it recognised the political nature of the legal system. Now, we had status from 72 to 76. Now, the tangible signs of status were that prisoners wore their own clothing, that they were not compelled to do prison work, that they had reasonable communication with their families, that they had the right to associate amongst the fellow prisoners, and they were entitled to remission of sentence.
Britain did not like this international statistic which prevailed in 75-76 of some 3,000 political prisoners in a tiny little. I mean, remember, the north of Ireland was only a 1.5 million people.
In 1976, Britain took an arbitrary decision, the Labour Minister, Merlin Rees, to take away political status, and he took away special category, making a public announcement on television that as and from the 1st of March 1976, all persons convicted of a scheduled offence committed after March the 1st, 1976, would be deemed to be common criminals.
This special status was taken from them, and so they went on protest. Now, up until that, they were allowed to wear their own clothes, so this was a change. The thing was to criminalise and degrade them, really, this was the idea, and get rid of this international statistic of political prisoners. They just say these are all murderers, bombers, shooters, this kind of talk. There's no talk of the hundreds of people who were completely innocent.
The criminalisation policy was based on one false premise. That was that the struggle, the armed struggle, regardless of what people think about the methods, was not based on political or social and economic dissatisfaction, but was based on the coming together of a bunch of psychopaths who wanted to destroy this nice norm of society by criminal struggle and by criminal acts of violence.
Paddy Bolger, Dublin H Block Armagh Committee.
Presently, 220 men in Longkesh and two women in Armagh enjoy special category status within yards of their comrades in the H Block cells and the other cells in Armagh jail. Dozens of Republican prisoners in Britain under a special security measure called special category A status enjoy the five demands. So we can see that Britain's decision to embark on this policy was not based on any principle about the implementation or the existence of the five demands, but purely on a political desire to suggest that the struggle was not a political one, but a criminal one.
In 1976, I was the first prisoner that comes to the new system and the new British process of injustice.
Kieran Nugent was the first to refuse to wear the prison uniform. His father comes from outside Cross MacLean, and recently I think they did a play about him.
I was sentenced to 3 years, sent to the H Blocks, and immediately after entering the H Blocks, I was stripped of all personal clothing. I was then ordered to put on a prison uniform, which I refused. I was beaten up and left in a cell. Within hours in that cell, the prison administration came to my cell and they threw a blanket around me. I didn't ask them for a blanket. They in fact started a blanket protest.
The whole escalation of events, which has now ended up in the hunger strikes and the death in the prisons, took place. And it's important to emphasise that at every step, In the process, this escalation has been forced on the prisoners by the British. They had all furniture removed from the cells. In addition to that, they were refused the right to associate with the other prisoners. They were refused the right to come out for exercise. They were refused the right to have visits. They were refused the right to have newspapers, radio, television, any contact with the outside world.
Our numbers began to build up. And the British government seen this. The British government seen how determined that we as Republican prisoners were, so they decided to try and smash the protest within a matter of months. Took a form of systematic beatings, starvation and isolation. At the same time, as our numbers built up, we became more determined in our efforts to secure political status, noting the fact that we knew that we were playing a major role in the overall struggle in Ireland by simply fighting at the British in the only way possible, and that was with our bodies. We class ourselves as captured prisoners of war. Republicans believe that when they're arrested, they simply continue to carry on the war while behind bars. At this stage, we were using the washing and toilet facilities. We were beaten up regularly, so we decided that we would be far safer was thrown into the cells rather than using these facilities. These beatings were given to us, and we believe that they were ordered at the highest level in the British government to smash the protest. This entailed placed against the wall, objects placed up our back passage and down our throat, and the British government said that this was in the interest of security. So in fact, the British government then forced us on the wash protest. So then we began to place the human waste on the walls. The reason being that because we had one mattress and one blanket. And if this human waste wasn't placed on the walls, it would be on our blanket and mattress, which we had to lie on.
So we had what became the no wash protest because the prisoners weren't able to get out of their cells to wash themselves.
You were naked. They passed remarks about your body. Especially the young prisoners were kicked and beaten. The older prisoners couldn't stand this any longer, and they said they wouldn't allow the young lads to go out any longer to suffer all these beatings. They were watched while they went to the toilet. There were half doors in the toilet. And terrible degradations. Remarks passed about their sex and all that kind of thing. There's nobody as vulnerable as a prisoner, and I've spent half my time making complaints of prisoners being beaten.
Of course, the British version of that is that this was some sort of propaganda coup, not only by the prisoners but by the IRA, which is totally false. I didn't like the way I was living, it was forced upon me. There's a whole lot of basic things which even an animal would get, and that simply was we were beaten up regular, but we weren't allowed access to medical facilities. And as regards the medical facilities within the prison, we believe that the doctors are working hand in hand with the British system and with the prison administration, and they have turned a blind eye on prisoners been very badly beaten up, been scalded with water, and generally harassed. We don't class them as doctors or anything else. These same people, I would class in the same category as the people who worked in the German concentration camps.
It was a most extraordinary sight to go into one of these wings. He opened the door, and then a most horrible sight was in front of you. A terrible smell, of course. More from the urine than anything else. The walls hardened with excrement. The windows broken, the rain coming in, the cold. And fellas with beards and long hair stood up. It really reminded me of Rip Van Winkle or something like that. So they endured those terrible conditions for 5 years.
The prisoners have now decided that they are still determined not to be broken. They are still determined that they will not be criminalised by the British, that they will not wear the prison uniform and thereby allow the British to term their struggle as a criminal conspiracy, thereby allow the British to term 800 years of Irish struggle as a criminal conspiracy, or indeed to label anyone around the world who's struggling for rights or justice as criminals. And they will not be broken. And so they've been forced now to fight with the last weapon that was available to them, and that is the weapon of their own lives.
See, there are also women were in prison without trial. I'm chaplain to the women's prison. And they also were in protest, although they couldn't impose the same punishments on the women. Instead of locking them 24 hours a day, they locked the women 23 hours a day. They gave them 1 hour outside. And on a famous date, the 7th of February, 1980, when they wouldn't let me into Armagh prison, they had a big search. They surrounded the girls. The girls protested. The men beat them. They were dragged, put into different cells. And the wing was taken over by male prison officers.
Maureen Gibson and Sheila Dara, ex-prisoners Armagh Women's Jail.
I was standing with my back to the rest of the wing, and I could only tell by the expression on the faces of the other girls that something had happened behind me. And when I turned around, the doorway to a corridor that connects A wing and B wing had been opened, and male screws were just filing out of it. There must have been about 30 or 40 of them. And they stood in a semicircle with their arms folded and their feet apart, cutting off all access to the rest of the wing. The governor then turned around and called for silence, and he said that there was going to be a search, and that while the search was being conducted, we wouldn't be allowed back to ourselves. He said we'd to collect our meals and go straight to the association rooms. Well, the meal screws were blocking the association rooms that stood in a semicircle, reaching from one side of the wing to the other. And the girls began to move forward. And, well, an example, one of the girls, Shirley Devlin, she was one of the first to move forward, and two male screws standing side by side, they stood aside to let her pass. A third male screw that was standing behind them grabbed her by the top of the hair, dragged her to the doorway of the tuck shop. Another male screw joined him. There was bedlam after that. The male screws just moved in and began attacking. There was absolutely no one in charge of the male screws. The governor of the prison, as soon as we began to move forward, he ran into the guard room. We were locked in the association rooms for must have been about 3 hours, and then we were told that we'd be taken up one at a time, searched, allowed back to ourselves, and then we would be given exercise. So each girl went out, got back to the cells, and the cells were completely wrecked. We never did get exercise. That was the beginning of the No Wash protest in Armagh Jail.
They tried to keep me out of the wings, but I had to bring in the cardinal and all that kind of thing. And sister going into the cells for 3 months, they didn't clean those cells out. And they deliberately did that in order to try to break the prisoners.
Then the male wardens came around again, and the windows were boarded up. This meant that there was no light or air getting into the cells. Above all, it meant that we couldn't pour anything out the windows. So we had to smear the contents of the chambers around the walls. And the reason for this, it killed the smell and it got it out of the way. So we were in a very, very bad state. Yeah? We were filthy. So were the cells. It was like living in a cave. And we were called animals. If any of the women prisoners were beaten up, when we asked for medical treatment, we were informed by Dr. Cole, who's the prison doctor, that we would receive no treatment from him until we conformed to criminalisation. Then he would treat us, which of course we refused to do anyway.
And I mean, you say, where were all the medical people? Where was hygiene? Where was all that sort of thing? It was unbelievable.
And that's the background leading up to the hunger strikes. To force the issue, Bobby Sands was the first to go on hunger strike until their demands, the five demands, were met. I don't know whether they thought that they would succeed quickly, whether they'd counted on Thatcher's utter intransigence. I don't really know. But as days went on over that summer of 1981, spring and summer of 1981, the young men began to die.
Mr. Robert Sands, a prisoner in the Maze prison, died today at 1:17 a.m. He took his own life by refusing food and medical intervention for 66 days.
Mama! Oh! Be fun. Your sacrifice will not be in vain. Today we rededicate ourselves and our struggles.
Francis Hughes died at 5:45 in the late afternoon local time. A short statement from the British authorities said only that he had died by refusing food or medical treatment for 59 days. Francis Hughes, aged 25 and one of a family of 10, had become something of a folk hero to the provincial.
The third man, Raymond McCreesh, died just after 2:00 in the morning, and there was a surprising couple of hours breathing space before the teenage gangs took to the streets.
I went over last night to see the body of Kieran Doherty, who will be buried today. You know, it was a terrible sight, the emaciated body, 73 days. So why did this man do that? I mean, you can't ignore that question. Life is precious to him and his mother and father, you know?
Well, I mean, one doesn't know exactly what's in the minds of the British government, if indeed there's anything in their minds at times. I don't think they understand at all how deep and how wide-ranging the impact of the hunger strike has been, and that's because they've blinded themselves for years. I mean, they've kept saying that the IRA is a tiny minority with absolutely no support, isolated from the community, etc., etc. And that was never true in the sense in which the British were saying it, and with the hunger strike, I mean, it has never been more untrue than it is now.
Mary McElwee, sister of Thomas McElwee.
Last week, three of us went up to see Thomas, and we sat in the seat until we were called for a body search. Went through the search into another waiting room, and there they take your name and address, who you're going to visit, as if they didn't know already. First of all, they opened a huge iron door, and the nurse was on the other side, and he brought us through. The warden came on through with us. We went through, and we're very distraught with the fact Thomas was lying on the bed. He was very thin. He's over 6 foot tall, and he weighs at the moment 43 kilograms. And you can imagine just what he would look like as a skeleton. The warden stood at the bottom of the bed, watching and listening to every word you'd say. We said we'll fight for him, and we won't stand for anything else other than the five demands. No, we're with him all the way, and whatever he does, we're behind him, and we know it's his decision to be on hunger strike. You don't blame the young lads for wanting the five demands, because it's only living they want.
Thus Britain needs 1,000 years, a protest, riot, debt and tears, or will this past decade, the fears of the 80s decade spell?
Bobby Sands, MP, Francis Hughes, Raymond McCreesh, Patsy O'Hara, Joe McDonald, Martin Herson, Kevin Lynch, Kieran Doherty, Thomas McElwee, Mickey Devine.
Obscenity be seen in the hate block cell.
There can be no question of political status for someone who is serving a sentence for crime.
When Britain has spent from 1976 until now trying to criminalize the prisoners, and six men have died in the most eloquent and starkest of statements, saying that it's impossible to determine, given our legal system, if we did anything. It's impossible for anybody to be reasonably sure that Bobby Sands was fairly convicted, any of the men inside or the women. What they are simply saying is, were it not for the existence of the political struggle, we would never be in a position that we would have broken any law. We are prisoners not only of the prison, but of the political problems. And they want recognition of that.
Crime is crime is crime. It is not political, it is crime. And there can be no question of granting political status. I just hope that anyone who is on hunger strike for his own sake will think fit to come off hunger strike. But that is a matter for him.
Her attitude was that they were criminals, convicted terrorists, and this open contempt she had for them and for the political program that they stood for created huge revulsion in Ireland. And memorably, when the third hunger striker, Raymond McCreesh, died, his brother, who was a priest, gave the eulogy in the village of Camla and memorably said, "My brother is not a criminal."
The prisoners have made every attempt. They don't want to die. But what they're doing is they're fighting with the last thing they've got left. And the choice, and they do have a choice, the choice is in the fight to live with dignity, to be prepared to die for it, or to live with no dignity, which is death.
Thirty years ago seems a long time. The partition of Ireland is still there. The border is ignored, effectively. Although the south of Ireland joined the euro, and the north of Ireland is still in sterling. But after 30-odd years, the people had no appetite for the war to go on. They were war-weary, and something had to give. Bitter antagonists like Paisley and Gerry Adams found a way to work together in the new assembly. But the lingering fear among many people in the Republican or Catholic communities would be that this is postponing a resolution of the problem. That, in the words of my father, "Ireland divided never can be free, and Ireland unfree will never be at peace." And it is notable that among the dissidents, one is Bobby Sands' sister, Bernadette Sands McKevitt. And her husband, Michael McKevitt, was recently convicted of involvement in a bombing in Oma, which was the last and worst atrocity in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The long shadow of Irish history is always there. The memory of the hunger strikers is very, very strong, very potent. They have entered into the annals of those who give their lives, who paid the supreme sacrifice in the cause of Irish freedom. This is an excerpt from a funeral oration delivered by Padraic Pearse. It was delivered at the funeral of a Fenian leader named O'Donovan Rossa. "Life springs from death, and from the graves of patriot men and women spring living nations. The defenders of this realm have worked well in secret and in the open. They think that they have pacified Ireland. They think that they have purchased half of us and intimidated the other half. But the fools, the fools, the fools. They have left us our Fenian dead. And while Ireland holds these graves, Ireland unfree shall never be at peace."
"I'll wear no convict's uniform, nor neatly serve my time, that Britain might grant Ireland's fight 800 years of crime."
In hindsight, we've been listening to "My Brother Is Not a Criminal," Bobby Sands and the H Block Hunger Strikes. The program featured interviews recorded by Brendan Frost in Northern Ireland in 1981 and a commentary by Jim Short. The music was by Martin Doherty. The sound engineer was Philip Ullman. And the program was produced by Jane Ullman. The 5th of May marked 30 years since the death of Bobby Sands.